Jit and Cody, comedians discussing obscure books with witty commentary. Odd books, bizarre books, awful books, oddball books, slightly racist, super racist. Get your fix from Cody and Runjit.
Welcome to Tome Foolery. And then normally Runjit would say Tome Foolery. And then,
Tome Foolery.
Thank you. All right. My name is Cody Melcher, obviously. This is Tome Foolery, special Out of Bounds edition. Runjit, sorry, my normal co-host was unable to make it down from Chicago, but it is me, and I have a lovely co-host and a lovely guest, and we're discussing White Rabbits by Leonora Carrington. Let me just go ahead and introduce my co-host. You know him, you love him, you remember him from the Doc Savage episode of the show, Mr. Peter John Burns.
Hello.
How you doing, Pete?
Good. I'm good.
All right. All right.
Good. Warm. Welcome to Texas.
I know. My mom's blaming me for the heat. She claims that I brought it up from 90 to 100 because, you know, that's what I do.
Yeah,
because
you're the second horseman of the apocalypse.
I think I'm a lot of the horsemen of the apocalypse, to be honest. I think you can find something in everybody. And then, of course, our guest, Minneapolis improviser Jill Bernard.
Hi.
Hi, Jill.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Cody.
How are you?
Hi, good. Really good.
Are you also warm?
Hey, man. This is you have to be ready for it.
Right.
You knew where you were going. You knew you got in the car on purpose.
We knew where we were getting into. I just realized that your shirt matches the wall, which is great for podcasting, that I'm mentioning that now. But
They're both a lovely shade of green.
Yeah. Oh, and so is the trash can. Wow, this whole room. It's just everything's coming together.
It's not a surprise that you happen to luck into color coordination, Mr. Melcher.
What do you want from me?
Just say, that's your karma. First horseman of the apocalypse and...
color coordination.
Yes, exactly.
Fair enough. Hey, you know what? We all can't work a Target. Jill, as usual, we want to start off with talking a little bit about you, since we are a book podcast, as it were. What did you grow up reading?
I was one of those kids who read everything because I read really fast.
Okay.
My favorite books were mostly about horses because I was a girl.
Sure.
At the time,
as one
I read
does.
A lot of.
I mean, to be fair, I read a lot about horses.
Did you?
Yeah.
Were you a girl?
No. We just had a ranch.
Yay! all the Marguerite Henry books.
Oh, nice.
I read through all the Little House on the Prairie books. I just read
a lot.
Yes. Well, a little bit. My family didn't watch TV.
Okay.
So I think I've read a lot.
That explains that with the reading as well, then, yeah.
Now, have you revisited the Little House books recently?
A few years ago, I took another look at them.
And was it good? Were you able to go home again to paraphrase Thomas Wolfe?
I'm not good at rereading in general.
Okay.
This is also what drew me to improvisational comedy. Like, if I've already read it, I know how this goes. Well, I never watch a movie
Beckett
again.
Had you read White Rabbits? White Rabbits.
White Rabbits. No,
I'm going to have this problem the whole podcast, that Elmer Fudd situation. Had you ever read White Rabbits before?
No, I hadn't.
Okay, good.
I hadn't.
Good.
White Rabbits being the story that we're all here to discuss.
Yes,
but
I said it earlier.
White Rabbits. I did look at the Little House on the Prairie books again, and mainly what startled me was the reading level is really elementary. I remembered them being challenging books, but they're really written very simply.
Mm. When my daughter was about 5, I started reading them to her as bedtime stories, and I was just surprised at how much of it was procedural.
Right.
Like, you know, Pa needed to make a vat for the honey, and he went step by step by laborious.
Well, I mean, I guess that's part of the learning process, though, because they are kind of teachable books. Like, they're entertainment, but they're also edutainment.
Yes, though I had no call for, like, putting things out of the reach of bears in suburban Evanston,
Illinois.
I also wonder...
You'd be surprised.
Like, she was honestly just writing her memories when she wrote those books. So I don't know... I mean, how much entertainment was she even thinking about? Some of them read like just her memories, just what she remembers happening. Right.
And later historians, not to disparage Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Go for it.
Have found that her memory was a bit sketchy in parts.
Oh, yeah. Like, everybody's memory is.
Right. Right. But it was sort of like, you didn't live there at the time that you said you lived
right.
there. And you didn't, you know, and Pa was actually a little more sketchy than you let on.
Right.
There's so many of those pioneers where it turned out that they kept moving west because they kept screwing up.
Yeah. Your father had been dead for 50 years. that was just a raccoon that lived in your house.
Wearing a small hat and playing violin, which was remarkable in its own right.
I know, right. I would have much preferred a story of a featured story about a raccoon wearing a small hat and playing a violin on the prairie. Where's that story? That's the book I want to read.
Oh, man. Let's get working.
all right. So, did you read anything, any other genres when you were a child? Maybe like in middle school, high school? Did you... Let's get your entire reading pathology.
When we moved into my grandparents' house when I was 11, and what was on the shelves there that they left behind was a lot of Isaac Asimov and Ray Bradbury.
Nice.
And at the same time, I was starting to steal my mother's romance novels.
Oh.
So I read a lot of Harlequin romance and my mom liked this series called Second Chance at Love, which was always these women who had been badly damaged in relationships and their hearts were hard, but they would meet someone and change. So like reading a lot of science fiction at the same time you're reading a lot of romance novels sort of made my brain and my aesthetic what it is, I believe.
Oh, I can dig it.
So you're a big fan of Ursula K. Le Guin then? Is that the intersection?
Nice call.
I don't even know.
We read a romance novel on this podcast with Jamie Campbell earlier that was about a woman who was trying to trick a millionaire into giving her a baby.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Did she succeed?
Yes, and then they fell in love.
Of course.
You know.
Yeah, as one does.
Yeah. I still am really into, like, I read them like as a going to sleep books. I read a lot of coming of age, coming out books, like those high school kid coming out stories, because they're just heartwarming, like, because they're kind of tragic, but then there's always a heartwarming ending for the most part, except for the few where they get suicidal.
Is there a Harlequin series for that now?
Not a Harlequin. It's just different. I live near a bookstore that has a gay section because I live in Boys Town.
Sure.
And so I just go in there and then I just pick a book up.
Sure. And they're on the lower shelf because they're for kids.
Well, you know authors. You get to know authors after a while, which are escaping me names at the moment. But yeah. All right. So what do you read now?
Well, I'm taking Spanish classes.
Bueno.
So, gracias. So I'm reading in Spanish almost exclusively, and I've finally gotten to like an 8-year-old. No, I'm still several years away from Don Quixote, but I'm at like an 8-year-old reading level.
Oh, nice.
Like a pretty stupid 8-year-old.
Hey, still an 8-year-old.
Yeah, which is great because now I'm starting to be able to read actual books that would be actually interesting. Before, like, little kid books are not really that compelling.
Little House on El Prairie.
Yeah, on El Prairie.
Yeah. Little Casa.
And the book I just finished reading, the only book I'm reading in English, is called Chi Running. You can learn how to run from a book, which has been a very odd experience because that's the
running sort of comes rather naturally to me, but I'm 5'4".
The book talks about that too, how we knew how to run when we were little kids. Little kids have better running form.
Okay, but little
than
kids
adults.
Suck at it.
I know.
They fall all the time. That's why they have skinned knees.
Well, they have balance problems.
Yes, but that's
and
why
they get too eager.
Yeah, but I'm saying that I'm not going to learn how to run from a child. I'm not going to learn how to cook from a child either.
Look, you can run. You can learn how to run from a child or run from a book. It just depends on how hard you throw the child or the book.
Hey-o.
Yeah. Pete, I also, again, visual, I just like that you're wearing your performer badge during the podcast because you're staying professional.
Yeah, well, because I am a professional.
There might be discounts. There might be discounts during the podcast.
Available during the podcast.
Well, I forgot it completely yesterday, and then I felt bad.
Oh, I did. I forgot mine the other day, too. Well, this is a great conversation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, visual for a performer badge that for a festival that's over.
All right, so...
I'm also reading a series of cartoon books in Spanish called Gaturo. Gaturo's a naughty little cat. He's like Garfield, but I enjoy him more. Like, he gets into trouble at school. Like, why is there a cat at school? And it's an Argentinian
series.
Kind of
like Rotten Ralph?
I don't know Rotten Ralph.
Rotten Ralph was like a little red cat who like loved... He was the pet of this girl, and they loved each other. And like, he would be rotten, but then like he'd feel bad about it, or like sometimes he'd try and do something nice and then it wouldn't go well because he had the misnomer of Rotten Ralph, everybody treated him poorly because of it. I mean, they always ended well.
Oh.
Does the Spanish cat like empanadas?
Hey.
Like, instead of in lasagna?
Yeah, what is his favorite food? It hasn't come up a lot. He doesn't have the eating disorder that Garfield has.
That's good. That's the American part of Garfield, isn't it?
His main flaw is that he's in love with Agatha, who doesn't love him back. Not Agatha Christie. Another cat, a cat named who wears lipstick.
Like,
who does
you
not
know, because you have to differentiate the genders.
Right.
But
right.
A bow wouldn't do it? Lipstick? That's a...
Well, yeah, I don't know. It's Argentina. Okay. Maybe they don't have a bow system that we do.
This, clearly more research is called for here.
Right. Like, what do bathroom signs in Argentina look like?
They just... Oh,
is it just two people and then one of them has red lips?
I'm trying to remember. How did I find the bathroom in Argentina?
You probably walked up and went, perdóname. Yeah. El baño? And they went, ahí. And you went, gracias.
Gracias.
That's very well done. You've got a second career coming in, like, books on tape for beginning Spanish.
Grew up in Texas. I only picked up a little bit.
Right. Uno cerveza, por favor.
There are some hilarious...
And if you need two, you ask it twice.
There are some hilarious books on tape in Spanish for learners where they switch back and forth between Spanish and English. There's one called The Case of the Missing Poodle that's a lot of fun to listen to because they'll do it half in Spanish, half in English. Then they'll do it. They'll let you listen to the chapter again, purely in Spanish, and it helps you really become absorbed in it. Then you can follow it.
Yeah, I mean that's kind of similar to like if you read anything or watch anything where it has like a person where it's an English speaking something, and they have a person who doesn't speak English, but will like jump back and forth between it, and so then they always have them like kind of repeat it, like they'll say it in their native language and then they'll repeat it in English. Same thing happened in Linden, which is the book that we read in the or we talked about in the live episode of the OOB podcast. There was a French character who would say something in French
and then repeat it in English
to clarify to his partner what he was trying to say.
Which is crazy, because I've never heard anyone do that in real life.
Like, true. But I mean, for a learning exercise, it's
great. Sure,
yeah.
Sure.
But I mean, look, we had a lot of problems with Dave Foster Wallace's writing structure in that podcast.
Well, I'm just saying, but it's a common trope where people do that in the movies, too, where they say, you know, they say it in Spanish and then again in English in case it wasn't clear.
I mean, like, in the not looking a gift horse in the mouth situation, I would say at least they... Like, at least they didn't just go straight into English, where it's like, well, no one whose second language is English when they're angry is just going to be talking in English the whole time.
Fair enough.
Like, for the most part. You know, in the same way that, like, it was a stupid thing to... It was a stupid thing when it happened at the time, but, like, when Valkyrie, the movie Valkyrie with Tom Cruise...
Sure.
It starts in German, and then, they do a thing where the camera shifts, and then it's English, but it's clear that, like, we're just getting, like, a Rosetta Stone.
We suddenly learned how to speak German!
Right. Like, basically, like, the screen has now become a Rosetta Stone, and everybody's still speaking in German, but we're hearing it in English. And it was kind of a stupid, hokey gimmick, but I at least appreciate that they're not trying to make... They're not trying to pretend like all the Germans in the Nazi Party just sat around speaking English.
You know, I saw a really wonderful new opera called Silent Night, and it's set in World War One, in the trenches, and it shows the various trenches of the various countries. It's about the Christmas truce.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The neat part about it is because opera listeners are used to it being in a language they don't speak. Like, most great operas are Italian or French or German, so people know that they're not going to get it. As a result, they played with that, and the whole opera of Silent Night is in all of the languages that would be appropriate in that scene. So that when we're in the English trenches, it's in English. When we're in the French trenches, it's in French. It was really cool. Really neat to get to just play with language in that way, knowing that opera listeners are fine with not getting it.
Well, and truth be told, you know, even if you're a native speaker of whatever language you're singing, once it gets put through the opera machine...
Right.
I felt like such an asshole. I spent 2 years studying Italian in college because I love opera so much. And then I finish. Like, I'm like, hooray, I'm done taking Italian. And then I still couldn't understand opera. And an Italian said to me, oh, yeah, we can't understand it either.
Right.
Right. Well, and the fascinating thing, one of the fascinating things that happens is opera fans go over to Italy not realizing that most Italian opera, the syntax of it, is archaic. So they go over talking like they're Shakespearean, like, dust thou? And it's like, oh, opera fan. Yeah, okay, look.
Yeah.
I almost, whenever I see operas in a foreign language, I almost get upset if they put translations in. Because it's hard to not look at them sometimes, but I don't want to just sit there and read the sentences.
Because you're a text-based person. Like, if there's text, I'm the same way. If there's text, I'll read it.
Right.
Even if I don't speak the language, like if there's subtitles on a movie, I saw Men in Black in Paris when it came out, And I read the subtitles even though I don't speak French. Like, why am I this person? I don't know.
Right, I have the same problem. It's partly motion-based, partly text-based. Yeah, because it's just there's something moving up there, and so I keep looking up and reading it. But then I'm missing a lot of what's actually happening in the opera and what I care about. And it's just like, I just would rather they didn't. But then again, people were wearing shorts in the opera, so what are you going to do?
Bastards.
I know. To your subtitle story, I was coming in at the end of a double feature, so the movie I wanted to see was going to start soon. But I was in Belgium, and the movie was Cinema Paradiso. They were speaking Italian, and then the subtitles were French and Flemish, and there are three languages going on. I didn't understand a word of any of them. So it was like, wow, look at all of this effort to translate, and I'm still, I got nothing here.
Not helping.
There's something beautiful about that, though. It's like, yeah, when we were driving down here about the, like, getting lost for the GPS thing, like, you can't. You know, it's nice to see that many like translations and things going on, that many technological aspects to try and connect everything together, and it's still not
lost
connecting.
On me, yeah.
And then there are parts of Cinema Paradiso that are in Sicilian.
Right, right. So even
so,
if you speak
even
Italian,
yeah. So there's a fourth mini language in there.
Yeah,
that's fun.
It's a beautiful thing.
I love language.
Yeah. You know what I love? Leprosy.
Oh. God, if only we could read a hilarious story about leprosy.
That was my...
Why did you make me read this story?
That was my terrible attempt at a segue.
Why did you do this? I'm not friends with you anymore because you made me read this weird story.
Two things. First of all, I didn't make you. I suggested it and you said yes. Second of all, way to wait until partway through the podcast to now inform me we're no longer
friends.
We're not
friends, yeah.
I drove you here. We had plenty of time for you to inform me that we're no longer friends.
All right. It's over.
You're just trying to create controversy. I see what this is.
This story.
Look, to be fair, I'm going to be blatantly honest. I had not read it when I suggested it. I had just heard of it, and I'd heard good things, and I heard it was short, and I was like, okay, well, we don't have a lot of turnaround time on it, and I didn't want to, like, you know, we all are doing a lot of stuff in the festival, and
this
so I wanted
not
to
the
give
way
us,
for War and Peace.
Right, I wanted to give us something a little easy to digest. I didn't know it was going to be this short either. For those at home, when I read it on my laptop, on the Kindle app on my laptop, it was about 3 to 4, maybe 5 pages. It was relatively short.
Yeah,
it was,
it's a really short story.
Right. It was 13 pages on my phone.
Although haunting.
Yes. We'll get to that.
It does a lot in that little brief period of time.
Right. And there. Because it's so short, I also read a lot of, I would have done this anyway, but I read a lot of articles written about it and written about her. And once you do that amount of background, much like a lot of artists, because to clarify, Leonora Carrington is a painter primarily and is known mostly for her painting.
Oh, is she?
She's a surrealist painter.
All right.
It's actually quite interesting stuff. I like surrealism, so I checked out her paintings, and they're very nice stuff. If you're listening at home, I recommend Googling her name, and her paintings will pop up. That's her primary, what she's known for. She fell in love with surrealism when she was younger, and she also fell in love with Max Ernst around the same time. And then a year later,
they hooked up.
A year later, they hooked up, and then they were in France, and he got arrested during at the beginning of World War II. He got arrested for being a foreign agent.
Who didn't?
Because he was a German. And then they let him go a couple of weeks later, and then Germany occupied France and arrested him for being an artist. So he had a fun time.
I like the way that you use the verb hook up with Max Ernst. I don't think, like, that seems not Teutonic enough.
They had a relationship for a period of time during that time, and then all that happened, and then he got dragged away, and then he got into a relationship that eventually fell apart. He got into a relationship with, I forget her first name, Mrs. Guggenheim, or Miss Guggenheim.
I see, of the New York Guggenheims?
Of the Guggenheims, yes. Yes. And so they got a relationship, and she's the one that brought him over to New York. In the meantime, Leonora Carrington had a complete and utter nervous breakdown and was sent to an asylum for a short period of time before she married a Mexican ambassador, because she was a Mexican-born British citizen.
Jill, do you feel like you've not accomplished enough in your life by listening to that little biographical sketch?
No.
No Mexican diplomats ever wander through my house.
Well, she escaped to an embassy.
I see.
And he agreed to marry her so that she could move to Mexico. So
then that's straightforward. That happens.
In the meantime, she went to New York to wait for the Mexican paperwork to clear. She moved to New York right before writing this. So this is roughly considered by some a somewhat autobiographical sketch of her feeling of displacement when she was thrown basically out of I believe she was in Spain at the time, maybe, when that happened. I don't remember when she moved to New York.
But she's so in New York waiting for Mexican paperwork.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so this is kind of a surrealist interpretation of how she was feeling at that time. Because there's a lot of, like, if you read in the beginning of the story, White Rabbit, there's a lot of her feeling like that New York isn't what was promised to her. She blatantly states it.
And I don't know if this is something you discovered in your reading, Cody, but
yes,
I'm a little like, so she moved to New York to wait to move to Mexico?
Yes.
Okay. Why not just stay in New York? That's understand. She's normally doing the reverse of what people.
Oh well, because the Mexican ambassador she married was from Mexico.
I don't know specifically. I would imagine that there might have been a possibility where she might not have been able to get documents to live
permanent,
in America. Yeah, permanent residency in America. That I would imagine would probably have been some of it. And she also already had citizenship in Mexico, I believe, of some kind or something. Because she has a connection to Mexico through her birth. So I believe that maybe it might have just been easier for her to go through.
Probably.
I didn't go through the naturalization paperwork.
I was just sort of curious. Like, look, you made it to New York. You've done it.
Right.
You know.
Well, also remember this. Max Ernst, who she has had a torrid history with, also lives in New York. A bunch of people that she has really rocky paths with also live in New York. So as you can see in the story, she may not have wanted to stay in New York.
Sure.
And in Mexico, there's like 100% less weird leper neighbors.
Okay. Well,
per capita.
In 1941, I'm not sure.
All right.
I'm just saying. yeah, and so that scene is part of the sketch of this, and a thing to know going into White Rabbits as well. And I recommend anybody at home read it. It's a part of a compendium called The Weird, which you can find on Amazon, on Kindle, or as a book. It's very short, as we said, and a trademark of her writing, which is very similar to her artwork and surrealism in general, is this kind of blunt, just window person who just experiences weirdness and is just very blunt about it, which I'm sure we all recognize in White Rabbits, where everything that happens to her, she's just like, okay.
I love how game this character is for that.
Right.
I mean, how this this whole story wouldn't happen if the character who we're saying is semi-autobiographical wasn't just so naturally curious.
Yeah. Well, and there's also a little bit of history in that. I'm sorry that I'm just lecturing here.
Please,
no, go ahead.
Please.
There's also a little bit of history in that. Leonora Carrington, when she was a child, was in love with Lewis Carroll. And so there's
so many young girls were.
Oh. And so there 'twas Brillig. And so the there's a lot of crossover between this story and Alice in Wonderland, or Alice in the Looking Glass. You know, a bored girl sees something, but in this situation, she has to, like, kind of force her way into it, basically. She has to go do the meet. And then, but the rabbits, obviously, are a very strong parallel. And just this curious girl who's bored and just game for anything.
Yeah. Right. And I'm really glad you told us she's a painter, because the story is so visual. The mm-hmm. visual descriptions of things in the story are just remarkable.
Yeah.
The kind of adjectives and descriptions that she's using are just very vivid, and maybe descriptions that I've never heard in any other story.
She uses a lot of painting technique in her words to, like, draw your attention to certain things like you would in a painting.
Right, it's also somewhat poetic in terms of its compression as well. I mean, I find myself thinking of Rainer Maria Rilke for whatever reason. In that sort of, like, strange unease and revulsion that sort of is
mm-hmm.
like at a low boil throughout this very short story.
Right. It felt like a person writing a Lovecraft book that was better at writing Lovecraft to a degree.
Well, but there was, like, how to put it, whereas Lovecraft tends to be sort of out front mm-hmm. with his mm-hmm. revulsion, this was sort of a low level of biological revulsion
right.
throughout. But it wasn't, despite some of the surreal aspects later in the story, like, you know, it's grounded in everyday objects, you know, rotting meat,
right.
the smells of putrescence and so forth.
Right.
Usually, you know, Lovecraft wants to tell you like a whole paragraph of how something's revolved, and she can do it in three words.
That's what I meant by better.
Yeah, yeah.
She's Lovecraft with an editor. But yeah, and
you're gonna get letters now, sir.
Hey, I'm game. I think we bashed Lovecraft. I think in the last episode or one of the last episodes. So let's just jump right into it because we've already previously discussed it. Lepers. That's a thing.
Right. I do think that Alice in Wonderland would have done better with a little more leprosy. Just a touch.
Just a little bit. Just I mean, I guess the cards do fall apart at some point, don't they, or something? I don't know.
Yeah, off with their head, but it turned out it wasn't the heading.
So at what point did you all guess leprosy earlier, or was leprosy basically when they said, we have leprosy?
The second. I was thinking it would be something more supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't occur to me that it would be something so realistic. Although the story starts so realistically, I think I was almost misdirected.
Right.
Because the story opens with just a description of summer in the city. That's like summer in any city.
Right.
It feels just a description of this apartment in New York, this landing in New York, looking out the window. I was expecting it to be more supernatural.
Right. Well, and I think part of it is the context of it being like a surreal, weird story might have started off that way. Also, I mean, the description of the skin is starry and things like that, and it felt very like regal. And so,
all thinking?
I went with aristocratic decadence. I wasn't expecting
leprosy,
a specific disease.
Okay, so when they were sparkly, was I the only one thinking Twilight?
I did for a brief moment.
You did. You thought vampires.
Sadly,
come on.
Sadly, I didn't think they were going to be vampires because I didn't think that retroactively Twilight has infected other works. But I did immediately think Twilight. But then I was probably. I mean, from the offset, I was just thinking general supernatural.
Me
like
too.
Like I was expecting it to be a woman who was like who had just been dead for such a long time but kept going through the motions or something, you know, or a witch.
I thought they were gonna somehow be immortal.
Yeah,
I assumed immortality.
I think it's because of the way she waved and the way she spoke, the woman.
Yeah.
I think it was some of that, the way she was dressed definitely gave an immortality which I mean ended up being correct.
Sure.
Yeah, so like I wasn't expecting leprosy either, but once leprosy was said, retroactively there is a lot of foreshadowing.
Sure.
Obviously Lazarus.
Yep.
Is the biggest foreshadowing for that. But then also I was reading one of the articles, it didn't even occur to me. So when the woman throws the meat out for the raven or the bones out for the raven and then washes and then cleans out the bowl with her hair.
Yes.
That is reminiscent of Mary cleaning Jesus's feet
with her hair.
She dries them with his hair. With her hair.
Yeah.
I never picked up on that.
And Mary was Lazarus's sister,
of course.
So, yeah.
I always found that, to be honest, a particularly unpleasant part of the Bible. I mean, I know there are other unpleasant parts, but I was just
this
like,
whole story
Lazarus
of Lazarus
and cleaning the feet.
The cleaning the feet with somebody's hair.
I found it weird because I'd forgotten about that part of the Bible. I found it weird that she was drying out a bowl with her hair. I was like, that's gross. Like, I'd rather have a gross bowl than gross hair.
Right, the same thing. I'm like, do you have a towel for my feet? Because that'd be fine. Yeah. Like, the Middle East. Your hair's not
Well, I mean,
great.
Also, yeah, like how absorbent is your hair?
No, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I agree.
Like get a steel wool. Go for it. I don't know. It seems similar.
Now, in your readings, I have to admit that I thought of this and did not think to look it up. Are rabbits known to be carriers of leprosy? I know armadillos are, but I don't know about rabbits.
I did not look that up.
Okay. I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. No.
We can make this a call-in show. Someone call in right now.
The rabbits, from what I had read and from what I was thinking,
yes,
seem to be kind of just like a perversion of something. So rabbits are a normally
vegetarian
creature that is also adorable and tiny, you know.
And peaceful.
Right, and usually if you own a bunch of rabbits, you're not eating them at the same time type of a thing. You know, like
really?
They're...
Yeah, where did you grow up?
There's like pet... Well, there's two types of rabbit. There's pet rabbits
and
there's...
meat rabbits,
meat rabbits.
Right.
But there are some households where that blurs.
Where the line is... Yeah, well, I just did go to the Minnesota State Fair.
Sure.
And as a city person, the Minnesota State Fair is hilarious because you're in one barn looking at turkeys, and outside of that barn is a place where you can buy a turkey and eat it.
Yeah, there is something, I mean, I guess more honest, but also stranger. But like, you've got the kid who's like, I've raised this pig, and like clearly has spent the entire year like making sure this pig was going to be a prize pig and whatever, and that's so we can eat it. Which seems, you know,
I mean, like I grew up around the rodeo, same thing.
Right. Well, I have kids because I was thinking about eating them, and then they got stringy.
Yeah, I don't know if your kids would be good for eating.
They were when they were babies. Pretty thin. I thought about it all the time.
Yeah, but you know, but then that's like veal, which I mean, it's good, but it's like, but I don't know. I like a little toughness in there. I like a little workout.
A little mutton instead of the lamb.
Yeah. Okay. You know.
But if you were a rabbit.
But if I was a rabbit, I'd want them to be.
What kind of meat would you want to eat?
Obviously, dead
with
meat.
With your buck teeth.
Obviously, like long dead meat.
Yeah.
Which was interesting. The idea that the rabbits didn't just eat meat, but they ate
rotting
meat
specifically.
But they didn't eat them. Also, I don't want to be that guy, but that was really well timed that her fingers fell off at that moment. She's kept them for a long time.
Right. But this is the first guest they've had.
Right. There was not a lot of waving before.
Well, you know.
I mean, wave goodbye. You know,
But she threw bones out for a raven. Like,
maybe that's why she invited her over, because she felt that the fingers were going.
she wanted to go out with a bang.
Exactly.
Oh man, I'm on my last. Yeah, these are gonna go.
Yeah, these aren't well attached.
Yeah. So yeah, and so like, does leprosy only set in after 7 years of exposure? I didn't understand the 7 years thing.
Well, the 7 years would be another biblical reference, I think.
Oh man. Nailed so it. Much Whoa. In one story. So much in one story.
Wow. I would also say that the rabbit's eating the rotten meat, if you think of, you know, a leper as being of rotting meat.
Right.
Yes, yes.
Right. Well, and I thought that too, but then I was like, why aren't the rabbits eating them?
Yeah, I think this is not the story where you ask plausibility questions, sir.
You know, every story is a story.
For rabbits, it's like a big step up to go from eating vegetables to eating rotten meat to eating live creatures.
Right. There's a hunting aspect that you're expecting the rabbits to.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, fair enough. I don't know. Maybe I read Benicula when I was a kid, and so then I'm just you know,
your
I'm expecting a little bit more from the rabbits.
A little more meat on your rabbit, so to speak.
Well, yeah. You know, I just want.
But
some...
Benicula didn't eat people.
No, he sucked the blood out of vegetables.
I remember because we got the vocabulary word blanche out of that book.
And you said a character on Golden Girls.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All at once. With an E.
Yeah.
Is it a feature of this show that you make at least one Golden Girls reference per episode?
I don't even watch Golden Girls. I've seen like 4 episodes of Golden Girls.
Really?
I'm a bad homosexual. We've covered this multiple times on this podcast.
Yeah. No. Sorry.
I am the blade of homosexuals. I am terrible.
You're just a gay walker. So.
you one-upped it.
Oh
man,
we're talking about that blade, right? Okay,
yeah, that blade. Yeah,
just checking in.
Oh man, that was well done. Oh,
have you ever listened to the DVD commentary on Blade?
I can't say that I have.
Everyone is trying not to say that Wesley Snipes is an asshole. I've never heard such great politics, such great like thesaurus work as not saying out loud, being really politically savvy and not
saying. He's really
saying,
intense about his work.
He
is meticulous.
Everyone is doing what you're doing, Peter, and that like clearly this man is a jerk. Just a big old jerk.
Listeners, you got 2 assignments. You have to read White Rabbits, and then you have to watch Blade with the commentary.
And you know, the DVD also offers a script download.
Jeez.
Of Blade.
I didn't.
And like, are you going to use it for auditions?
Right.
Or are there some monologues
that's
in there?
It's not really a script I ever felt like I needed to scholastically peruse in any capacity.
Well,
it's available.
If you're writing your spec script for Blade 4 now that he's back out. I would also suggest to your listeners, if you're going down the Blade rabbit hole, so to speak, you track down Patton Oswalt's interview about being part of Blade Trinity.
Oh God.
Patton Oswalt.
Is he in that?
Yes, and he talks quite explicitly about what an asshole Wesley Snipes was. Like finally, like the statute of limitations had expired.
Someone has to say it. Someone has to say it out loud.
Oh,
the director actually hired bikers to threaten Wesley Snipes with bodily harm.
Doesn't surprise me.
No.
So get ready for Blade 4, hide the money and run. It's gonna be so good.
It's gonna be so good.
What upset me about the Wesley Snipes chase was that he thought he was better than Al Capone, and that upsets me.
That's where you're drawing the line.
Yes, that's where I'm gonna draw the line.
We all have our own reasons for drawing the line on Wesley Snipes, you guys.
Yeah.
I did. I one minor thing I will say that I found weird. I mean, amongst all of them,
like, yeah.
Here's really low on the totem pole of weirdness based in the story, but like,
got it.
All of the British spellings and British euphemisms about being in New York.
Yes,
like it was like, okay, so clearly you are not from here, I think. But there was also a way of describing New York where I'm like, I think you're describing London. I think that's what you're describing.
Yeah,
it just happens to be New York.
They said the plague. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's what I'm saying is when you read a lot of the biographical information, it sounds like an autobiography of like that it is about London, but it's about New York, but it's about London.
I mean, that's really interesting that she had just moved to New York.
Yeah.
So this is your initial feelings on a place. Maybe you don't know the ins and outs yet.
Right. Right, and you're just you're bored, you're sitting alone, waiting.
Isn't that funny? Do you do this when you travel? Like, you try to make every city seem like another city that you know? When I go to a city, my brain can't help but compare and try to make it seem like a city that I already know. Maybe that's just a protection defense.
Like, I tend to be more disappointed the opposite way. I'm like, I want to find, you know, where the authentic Tulsa is, and I'm like, oh, it's just Chili's again. Okay,
yeah.
Damn it.
Right, yeah, that's the problem I run into. I either don't leave my hotel room or, like, I'll Google something to go to, and then I'll go to it, and then I'll ask somebody there, what's the next thing I should do? And then I go to that, and then I ask somebody there, what's the next thing I should do? I basically just try and find locals. And they may be wrong, because, I mean, if you're in Chicago and you ask me, what should I do? I'll be like, I don't go out.
Perhaps you could go to Navy Pier.
We went to Indianapolis and we asked everyone, we're like, what do you like about Indianapolis? And people would pause for a long time. And then they'd say, sports? With a question mark on it.
That's sad.
And then they would say the Children's Museum. And we'd always ask them three things. No one could come up with a third thing. It was a long pause. Sports? We have a good Children's Museum. And that was it.
You know, I had going back to my Brussels experience where I saw Cinema Paradiso, that's why I ended up in the movie theater, because my college roommate and I were sort of doing the postgraduate bum around Europe, and we're in Brussels, and we went up to some locals, because, of course, so many people speak English, especially with NATO there. We said, what do you do around here? And they're like, nothing. Why'd you come here? Because in the guidebook it said, and they're like, no, I mean, the streets roll up at night. I mean, go have a beer, and then a movie, maybe. So
when I moved to Cedar Rapids, Iowa to go to college, it was orientation, like freshman orientation weekend. My mom and I are standing there, and she said to a man that we saw, she said, what's a good restaurant to go to? And the man, without a trace of irony, said, there's a really good Perkins here.
It's
and it was just this foreshadowing of the of the years to come.
Oh, yeah.
There's a really good Perkins here.
Right, because it's a Perkins that cares, not like those bastards
right.
in Dubuque.
Like there's a scale of Perkins.
Oh, those Dubuque bastard Perkins.
They're just phoning it in Dubuque.
I was listening to an interview on NPR with the mayor of Robbins. Like she was like in her 70s or something.
Robbins, where's that?
It's a small suburb just south of Chicago. And so I came in towards the end of the interview, and he just goes, so basically towards the end he goes, well, do you have anything else you want to say about Robbins? She goes, no, that's pretty much it.
That's awesome.
And then he goes, and then he says, all right, well, this has been so-and-so, I forget her name, mayor of Robbins, Illinois. If you ever have any time, I really suggest you just get in the car, drive on down there. It doesn't have any nice restaurants or theater like Schaumburg, but what it does have, and I'm generally quoting here, but what it does have is it has a couple of thousand people just trying to make it through. And I was like, that is the worst pitch ever.
That is the worst, trying to make it through.
Let's say, hey, honey, let's get in the car. Let's take the kids down to Robbins and we can watch some people struggling.
That'll be inspiring.
If you're thinking about slashing your wrists, I would suggest making a drive down to Robbins, Illinois.
Yeah. And as Peter laughed, the foil of Robbins is Schaumburg, Illinois.
Right. Schaumburg.
Culture capital.
There's a lot going on in Schaumburg.
Hey, you know what's great about Schaumburg? Sports. And they've got a nice children's museum.
And trail off, end of sentence. It was one of those low self-esteem things, too,
yeah.
Like where people sometimes don't know what's great about their city or won't brag about it. Like Indianapolis has more public art than any city. They just throw up public art almost randomly. Like here's a trailer park with an incredible sculpture in front of it.
Yeah.
Like, that's beautiful and cool, but no one's going to brag on that. I never try to sell people on Minneapolis because the fact that it's uncrowded is one of the things I enjoy. So if anyone's like, I hear it's really cold there, I'm like, yeah.
So if I may be so bold, you're the Scooby-Doo ghost of Minneapolis. You're like, if you had your druthers, you would just scare all of the people out of the carnival.
Right.
So that no one would come
right.
back to Minneapolis.
So I could live in my haunted city by myself.
So you have plausibility problems with this story, but not with Scooby-Doo.
No.
Because every episode of Scooby-Doo, when has there ever been a smuggling operation where someone said, you know what, I'm going to dress in a giant mascot suit, and that'll distract everyone?
There have actually been plenty. like bank robberies, constantly they do stuff like that. And there have been like long cons where criminals get the idea. Now, there may be a chicken and egg scenario where we're not sure if they got the idea from Scooby-Doo or what have you. But there are definitely historical stories of crimes or things like that. I mean, come on. In the Trojan War, they thought, let's put a bunch of people on a giant horse and this will work out well.
Well, it worked once.
Well, yeah.
But it's a not. It's
but all you need is once, Pete. Tell that to the Trojans.
I'm just saying, it's not a, like, you know, it's sort of like the 9/11 thing. You can't do it again. Like, the second guy that showed up with a big horse, everyone went, come on, we know.
Come on.
But that's why he then showed up with a large whale. And then they were like, all right, well, this works.
Oh, yeah,
it's not a horse. They said no large horses, but this is a whale.
This is a wooden whale.
This is a sea
totally
horse.
Different.
So we're good. It's totally different, guys. There's no way there could be anybody inside. Oh, he fooled me once, shame on me. Fooled me twice, but you can't trick me again. That's the
fool me three times. Why are you like this?
Yeah.
Why are you like this?
You have serious problems, and you need
to go
see a therapist.
You're not
paying
attention.
You need to work through. You need to work through what is causing you to exercise control on other people in
constantly.
This kind of a way. Man,
see, I was thinking of the victims, and I thought there was like they had trust issues, but the wrong kind. Where like you just, oh, thank you for this lovely horse. I can't see how this could go against me.
Yeah, they're just like, I just want a horse. I just really want a large wooden horse.
You know what? To be honest, I still like the horse. Yes, an army climbed out inside, but they left the horse. That's beautiful.
Yeah. Did they burn the horse down with the rest of Troy, or did they leave the horse in the middle?
Oh, I wonder.
Excellent question. I don't believe Virgil addresses this in the Aeneid, but that might be one of that lost. That's the director's
it's
cut.
It's a lost chapter.
It's a lost canto.
It's the lost. It's the lost part of the Laura Ingalls Wilder chapter of the Trojan War, where she lists all of the people who went around and killed people, and then this is what they did with the. This is how you build a wooden horse. And then Pa had to go out build the wooden horse,
right,
with Achilles. Jill, do you have any final thoughts on White Rabbits? Any summaries or things that you want to let the audience at home know before they read the book or the short story, rather?
I think we covered it.
You said it all.
I think.
What's your stance on lepers?
Knowing that lepers, I'm very pro leprosy. It's funny to read a book before we knew a lot about leprosy.
Yeah.
Like leprosy used to be a much bigger deal than
now.
It
it's called
right
Hansen's
now.
Disease, not related to the band.
Yeah. So it
but
is.
We always hope.
No, I love Hansen. They are talented musicians.
This is almost like, you know, when you watch the musical Rent right now, it doesn't have the punch now that AIDS has more treatments available.
Right.
And this is the same way. Like, leprosy is not as horrible as it was in times gone by. You don't have to live in a colony necessarily now, unless you want to hang out.
Yeah,
but,
you know.
I think that's called a support group now.
Yeah.
It's now voluntary.
It's right. Nudist colonies.
Right.
Yeah. Pete, do you have any final thoughts on White Rabbits?
I think that everyone should read White Rabbits to be convinced that rabbits are really creepy.
Yes.
I've always felt that.
Yeah. The
Watership
eyes.
Down be damned.
It's all in the eyes. It's all in the eyes.
Yeah.
And those twitchy little mouths.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. They're,
once
they're,
you think about them eating rotted blue meat.
Rabbits are squirrely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A squirrely rabbit. Yeah. Because rabbiting isn't quite the adjective you want it to be. Yeah.
They're totally rabbity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're plotting. That's what the thing is. They're plotting.
White Rabbits by Leonora Carrington.
Feed your hair. Feed your hair. We haven't done any White Rabbits.
I was going to say, how the hell do we get this far before getting very slick?
Chase some rubber.
So White Rabbits by Leonora Carrington, I would say it's a fun summer beach read. you know, go lay out by the pool. Take a
watch
nap.
Your skin sparkle.
Yeah, watch your skin sparkle, and then, you know, think about how many people odds are that have leprosy at the pool with you, especially if you're at a public pool. It's fun to think about. And then get in the water with them.
Yeah.
Avoid all large cities.
Oh man. All right. Well, Jill, do you have any do you have anything coming up or anything you want to point people out to?
Every Monday night I'm at Show X at Huge Theater in Minneapolis. Cool. You can visit us at hugetheater.com. We have shows all week long and classes too.
You have a Twitter?
Yeah, JillyB72. You can just look it under Jill Bernard.
Fair play.
I let the other Jill Bernard have Jill Bernard on Twitter. There's a motivational speaker named Jill Bernard.
You're a kind person.
Who probably hates me.
Yeah, my goal in life has been to be the most popular Cody Melcher. Like I sometimes will Google myself not to see who's talking about me, but to see if any of the other Cody Melchers have started moving up the like Google results poll.
You're our favorite Cody Melcher.
Oh, you're the best. Yeah. Be the best Cody Melcher you can be. In the early days of the internet, I would occasionally get contacted by other people named Peter Burns. Not Peter John Burns, but Peter Burns.
Right.
And they'd be like, hey, isn't it crazy? We've got the same name. And I was like, now I'm going to kill you and take your essence. You've stolen a part of my soul, sir.
My family legend is that the reason we're Bernard, the name was originally Bernhardt.
Oh.
And, but
Ellis Island sanded the rough edges off
of
that.
Well, we say that the family legend is that Sarah Bernhardt, the famous actress, was the only other Bernhardt with a telephone when telephones were new. So they switched our name to Bernard, which seems really fishy to me.
I just didn't have a phone.
I just love that you have family legends. That's awesome.
Doesn't everybody?
It makes me think that you live in a castle with like a lot of portraits of people that look a lot like you.
Doesn't everybody? Weird. Okay.
Not terribly.
We have less legends than just sort of anecdotes.
Yeah, we have just horrible stories that happened to my grandparents. Like, like my grandfather grew up in Swiss Alp, Texas, only speaking German during World War I, and so people threw rocks at him.
Well,
have the Melchers just been persecuted from town to town?
Are literally the Addams family.
Well,
that's just us. That's what we do. It's a lot of misery. But anyway, speaking of misery, Peter, you got any shows coming up?
Hey-o.
If this podcast didn't depress you enough, you can come listen to my podcast called This Week in Despair, where we look at the week's news and try not to kill ourselves at the end of it.
And you're also recording a live podcast after this one, but it'll come out. I don't know what the conjunction between our two podcasts coming out will be. But
right. There's going to be some sort of time paradox warp thing.
But you're doing a live one at Out of Bounds with James Fritz and Zach Peterson. That's going to be a lot of fun.
I hope so. Otherwise, you'll find out otherwise. Either way.
Yeah, go over to Week in Despair and find out.
Right.
It's like the internet's alive. Yeah. Cool. All right. And then I've been Cody Melcher at Eccentric Gent. You can find me there. Check us out at Tomefoolery. You can also find us on iTunes, Facebook.com/Tomefoolery and Tomefoolery.com. Of course, I'm Cody Melcher. My usual co-host is Ranjit Sari. But thank you, Peter, for stepping in.
Thank you for having me.
And our guest, Jill Bernard. Thank you, Jill.
Yeah, don't go chasing rabbits.
Don't go chasing rabbits. Thank you again to Rob Scallon for our theme and his brother John Scallon for our theme song. And thank you to Olin Kidd for our logo. And remember, kids, pros before hoes. Have a good night.